Decision podcasts are brought to you by the New York Prosecutors Training Institute. Find this and other decisions at NIPTI Law. www.nipti.org/law.
People v. Dunton decided on April 23, 2024. Rivera, J. The issue on this appeal is whether the appellate division erred in granting defendants writ of error coram nobis on the ground of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failure to assert a claim on direct appeal that defendant was improperly removed from the courtroom without prior warning during the announcement of the verdict and the polling of the jury. Because a prior warning was not practicable under the unique circumstances of this case, the trial court did not violate defendant's statutory and constitutional right to be present during this material stage of the trial, and appellate counsel was not ineffective for omitting this non-meritorious claim. Therefore, we reverse the appellate division. 1. Factual and procedural history. Defendant Corey Dunton was 16 years old when he opened fire into the Bryant Park skating rink at a 17-year-old who refused to turn over his jacket. The shots struck the victim 4 times, wounding his hands and legs. Another stray bullet struck a 14-year-old bystander, which left him paralyzed from the waist down. For these acts, a jury convicted defendant of attempted murder in the second degree, Penal Law Sections 110(0), 125.25(1), 2 counts of assault in the first degree, Penal Law Section 120.10(1), 3, 2 counts of criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree, Pam 10T and Tom Rin signed and Tew and Tender signed 200 Siction 200 Sikton and Trenditin Trending Sen Tanitunchendainter. On this appeal, we are concerned with the circumstances that informed the trial court's decision to remove defendant from the courtroom during the reading of the verdict based on his disruptive behavior. As the record establishes, the court and law enforcement officials considered defendant a security threat. Defendant's detention at Rikers Island pending trial was marked by several violent outbursts, which the prosecution reported to the court and required adoption of various security precautions. For example, before jury selection, the prosecutor informed the court that there had been a host of incidents, some charged, some indicted at Rikers Island. These incidents included unprovoked assaults on another inmate and a corrections officer, and possession of weapons. The prosecutor informed the court that video footage from one such incident showed defendant throwing a plastic chair which bounced off the wall and hit an officer, then showed defendant repeating the action with a second chair. The prosecutor further stated that defendant's record at Rikers was rife with these types of incidents. Based on this information and for security reasons, the court ordered that defendant not stand and only turn his head, but not his body when introduced to prospective jurors. As the trial progressed, corrections and court officers apprised the court of defendant's continued violent conduct, which led the court to take additional security precautions. On one occasion, defendant created a flood situation in a holding area and punched an individual who responded. The court noted for the record that this misbehavior resulted in stricter security during transportation to the courthouse, and that defendant's other alleged acts of violence against officers and fellow inmates only heightens whatever tension there may be in the courtroom and puts everyone on heightened awareness. On another occasion, officers informed the court that during a break, defendant spit at an officer and damaged a computer. Officers did not arrest defendant only to avoid delaying the trial. The court also observed that defendant was at times malingering or otherwise attempting to delay trial, which resulted in a rebuke from the court that it would not tolerate any purposeful delays. The court specifically warned defendant that, if for any reason defendant failed to appear in court because of his own doing, the trial would go on without him. Defendant's misconduct extended to the courtroom, increasing concerns about witness and juror safety and leading to more warnings and the continuation of security measures. For example, after the prosecutor told the court that a witness for the prosecution and members of the gallery had informed him that defendant was staring down the witness during her testimony, smirking and laughing at her and covering his mouth, which, according to the prosecutor, was a signal for the witness to keep her mouth shut. According to the prancing self-appropriately and not act in any way in nani nadim. Then, when defendant later took the stand in his own defense, Counsel made a request that defendant be permitted to stand and point to a chart. The court denied the request, stating it would put defendant 5 or 6 feet from the jury without any physical restraints, and that allowing him near the jury was contrary to corrections and court officers' recommendations. Notice of defendant's continued alleged violent attacks outside the courtroom put the court and law enforcement on heightened alert of a potential in-court outburst given the impending verdict and defendant's explosive tendencies. Specifically, toward the end of trial, the prosecutor informed the court that earlier in the week defendant, without warning, punched another corrections officer in the face, and that, as in prior incidents, chemical agents had been used to subdue defendant. At that point, the court stated its intent to place defendant in handcuffs for the reading of the verdict, citing the safety of everyone in the courtroom. Defense counsel objected to the handcuffing and pointed out that, throughout the trial, defendant had behaved like a gentleman in the courtroom. The court agreed, but explained that because defendant had multiple times punched someone entirely unprovoked and by surprise, he might, for no reason, out of the blue, just throw a punch at someone in the courtroom. When the jury notified the court that it had reached a verdict, the court brought up the restraint issue again and clarified that court and corrections officers had requested that defendant be restrained. The court further explained that it had reviewed video footage of one of the earlier altercations, which it described as depicting defendant clearly trying to escalate and create some hostility. The court further observed that corrections officers were able to de-escalate the situation only through their patience and professionalism. In response, defense counsel argued that defendant had earned the right not to be cuffed through his good behavior in court, and informed the court that defendant had given counsel his assurance that he would remain calm during the announcement of the verdict. The prosecution said it would defer to the recommendation of the court officers, but again pointed out that defendant had 6, perhaps 7 pending indictments arising from incidents that occurred at Rikers Island with corrections officers and fellow inmates. The court ordered defendant to be handcuffed, citing defendant's documented history of acting out and becoming violent and being physically aggressive with court personnel and fellow inmates. The court commented that it had seen things get ugly very fast in a courtroom, and that it was weighing the safety and well-being of those in what the judge described as a quite small courtroom. After defendant was produced, the court informed him that he was being handcuffed for the safety and security of everyone in the courtroom, and that the court wanted to make sure that everybody remains in control and nothing happens. Defendant indicated that he understood. The jury entered the courtroom, and the foreperson announced, without interruption, the verdict of guilty on each of the first 5 counts. At that point, defendant audibly laughed. The foreperson continued and announced guilty on the 6th count. Defendant then interrupted and the following took place. The defendant: you thought that was gonna break me. I thought about sentencing. I don't care about sentencing. You think you all broke me. Y'all didn't break me. The court: please control your client. The defendant: I'm good. You all didn't break me. Give me the whole 50 years. I don't give a F about nothing. It's over. It is what it is. All 12 of y'all can sit there and say you all did the right thing. That's what I want y'all to know. Live with that. Live with that. Live with that. The court: officers take charge. The defendant: live with that. It is what it is. I ain't gonna walk out of here. What y'all done ain't gonna break me. You ain't gonna see me cry. I'm walking out the same way I came in, immaculate. Suck my D. Court officers then removed defendant from the courtroom. In defendant's absence, the foreperson announced a guilty verdict on the 7th and final count, and the court polled the jurors, who each concurred in the verdict. Once the jurors were excused, the court put the following on the record. The court: Mr. Dunton began to act out. He became quite verbally abusive, began screaming out profanity. It became upsetting. I saw the jurors were becoming upset. I allowed it to go on for a few seconds. I allowed it to go on for a few seconds. I tolerated it for a while. Eventually, I did ask the court officers to take charge and have him removed from the courtroom. In hindsight, it appears the right decision to have him handcuffed in the courtroom. The court then asked whether the attorneys had any motions, and defense counsel said he had nothing further. On direct appeal, defendant argued that 1. Arresting officers violated Peyton v. New York by coercing him to leave his apartment. 2. Inculpatory statements he made during fingerprinting should have been suppressed. 3. The lineup identification was unduly suggestive. And 4. The people's summation deprived him of a fair trial. The Appellate Division, First Department, affirmed the judgment, rejecting all of defendants' arguments. This court denied leave to appeal. Shortly thereafter, the Second Department reversed a conviction in People v. Antoine, where the defendant had made a disruptive verbal outburst after the guilty verdict was read, but before the jury was polled, and the court concluded that the trial court erred in failing to issue any warning to the defendant before removing him from the courtroom. After Antoine was issued, the appellate counsel who supervised defendant's direct appeal contacted the Office of the Appellate Defender, Ode, regarding filing a writ of error coram nobis on behalf of defendant. Ode filed the writ, arguing that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the following three claims which would have necessitated vacatur of the appellate division's order and or reversal of the judgment. 1. The trial court violated defendant's constitutional and statutory right to be present during the rendering of the verdict when it removed him from the courtroom without prior warning. 2. The point in question. 2. Semderentiori now termimur thanderwin stamwayarn trimuatonar. And 3. Defendant's maximum sentence of 25 years was excessive given his age and history of trauma and mental health issues. In support of the writ, defendant submitted an affirmation from the supervising attorney in which counsel stated as to the first claim that to the best of his recollection, he did not consider raising a challenge to defendant's removal from the courtroom during the verdict without sufficient warning. The appellate division granted the writ, vacated its prior order affirming defendant's judgment of conviction, reversed the judgment, and ordered a new trial. The court concluded that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise a mode of proceedings error based on defendant's ejection from the courtroom without prior warning during a material stage of the trial, in violation of his Sixth Amendment right to be present. Based on that decision, the court did not consider defendant's other arguments in support of the writ. A judge of this court granted the people leave to appeal. 2. Defendant's removal without warning was proper. The prosecution argues that the trial court's removal of defendant from the courtroom was a proper exercise of discretion because, given his history of violent outbursts, the court had reason to believe defendant posed an imminent risk of harm. Alternatively, the prosecution contends that any violation of defendant's right to be present was de minimis and would not require reversal because he was present for 6 of the 7 counts, and the recitation of the verdict is a mere ministerial act for which defendant's presence would have made no difference. The prosecution further suggests that the court's warnings to defendant that the trial would continue in his absence should he fail to appear based on his out-of-court misconduct were sufficient to put defendant on notice that the court could remove him for any in-court misbehavior. Defendant contends that his removal without advance warning was unlawful based on his prior good behavior in the courtroom and the fact that he was handcuffed during a purely verbal outburst, and counters that there is no de minimis exception to the right to be present. Defendant also argues that CPLA 260.20 entitled him to a warning specific to in-court conduct. We reject the prosecution's claim that any error was de minimis based on the timing of defendant's removal from the courtroom. There is no material stage of the proceeding that is any less consequential to a defendant's right to be present. However, we agree that the trial court's actions were appropriate under the unique circumstances of this case, and in no way contrary to law. A defendant has a constitutional right to be present at all material stages of their criminal trial, which includes the reading of the verdict and the polling of the jury, People v. Ramirez. See also People v. Sanders. A defendant is still presumed innocent until the jury returns to the courtroom, publicly announces the verdict. Further, CPLA 260.20 provides that a defendant must be present during the trial, but may be removed if they are disorderly and disruptive, such that the trial cannot be carried on with the defendant in the courtroom if, after they have been warned by the court that they will be removed if they continue such conduct, they continue to engage in such conduct. A court may dispense with the constitutional and statutory warnings when it is impracticable to give them. People v. Palermo, see Edge. People v. Byrnes. The trial court did not err in removing the defendant without warning when he leaped on the counsel table and lunged in the direction of a witness in an assaultive manner. People v. Wilkins, same, where the defendant suddenly charged across the floor and attempted to attack the prosecutor. People v. Jackson, same, where the defendant punched his attorney in the face and then engaged in a agent and ad in Janjan and Bantin. That was the case here. The court and corrections officers considered defendant a safety risk. Their concerns were justified based on defendant's history of alleged violence at Rikers against corrections officers and inmates, and his possession of weapons, and his in-court intimidation of a prosecution witness during her testimony. To ensure the safety of the jury and all those present in the courtroom, the court imposed security measures limiting defendant's movements. Thus, the court prohibited defendant from standing during his direct testimony because of his close proximity to the jury and restrained defendant in accordance with court and corrections officers' recommendations. Defendant's delaying tactics also led the court to admonish him 3 times that it would proceed without defendant should he fail to appear. These concerns and the tension caused by defendant's conduct reached their apex once the jury announced it had reached a verdict. Although counsel conveyed to the court defendant's assurances that he would remain calm, the court ordered defendant be handcuffed and explained to counsel and defendant that this was for security reasons. In disregard of his professed assurances and demonstrating his contempt for the proceedings and the court, defendant disrupted the announcement of the verdict 3 times. First, he laughed after the foreperson announced guilty on 5 counts, including the top count of attempted murder. Second, moments later, after the foreperson announced guilty on the 6th count, defendant directed a verbal outburst at the jury. Third, after the court instructed counsel to control defendant, defendant continued his tirade, using profanity directed specifically at the jury. It was only after defendant could not be controlled, and the jurors had become visibly upset by defendant's verbal abuse, that the court directed the officers to take charge and defendant was removed from the courtroom. Contrary to the dissent's view, the totality of defendant's misconduct in and out of the courthouse rendered a warning to defendant immediately preceding his removal impracticable, see dissenting op. et 2. Any delay in defendant's removal would have permitted further disruption of the proceedings and risked physical danger to the public, jurors, judge, court officers and staff and the lawyers. As the court had earlier observed, things get ugly very fast in a quite small courtroom. The fact that defendant was handcuffed did not eliminate the possibility that he could physically move about and further disrupt the proceedings and injure those in attendance. Indeed, defendant had previously displayed violent sudden outbursts, and there was no certainty that handcuffs would prevent him from reacting in the same manner. There was also good reason for the court to doubt that defendant would heed a warning in the middle of an outburst and immediately preceding his removal. After all, defense counsel was unable to control defendant during his outburst, which was in disregard of the court's efforts to maintain safety in the courtroom and was a direct attack on the jury and its effort to complete its solemn duty. Further, any incentive defendant may have had to maintain composure during trial, while in the presence of the jury, was no longer present once the foreperson announced guilty on 6 of 7 counts, including the top count of attempted murder. These factors informed the court's reasonable on-the-spot decision that it needed to remove defendant swiftly to ensure the safety of everyone in the courtroom. Contrary to the dissent's claim, defendant's removal did not violate the constitutional warning requirement set out in Illinois v. Allen. There, the defendant was verbally obstreperous and used vile and abusive language purposely to disrupt the trial. He did not have a history of unprovoked violence like defendant here, nor did the trial court remove him for any legitimate concern about the security of the courtroom. The dissent also makes the baseless assertion that we have created a new rule, see dissenting op. 2. The rule is well established and unchanged by our decision here. A defendant must be warned that their continued disruptive conduct will result in removal from the courtroom unless such warning is impracticable under the circumstances. It will be the rare case where waiting to provide such warning imperils the safety of those in the courtroom. But this is such a case, notwithstanding the dissent's attempts to recharacterize defendant's actions as unremarkable. Defendant was repeatedly violent in and out of the courthouse, requiring additional security. He blatantly disregarded his assurance that he would remain calm during the announcement of the verdict, and the jurors were visibly disturbed by the outbursts defendant directed at them. A warning to defendant during his verbal tirade was simply impracticable. A court with a reasonable basis for its security concerns based on a defendant's prior violent conduct, disrespect for the solemnity of the proceedings, and inability to maintain their composure after promising they would, need not wait until the court's fears are realized. C. Wilkins, a defendant, should not be permitted one free swing. 3. Ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. In the context of a quorum nobis application, appellate advocacy is meaningful if it reflects a competent grasp of the facts, the law and appellate procedure, supported by appropriate authority and argument. People v. Alvarez, Iting People v. Stultz. Effective appellate representation by no means requires counsel to brief or argue every issue that may have merit. Rather, appellate attorneys are afforded wide latitude in deciding which points to advance. Iting Stultz. However, even a single failure which undermines confidence in the outcome of the proceedings before the court, Strickland v. Washington, or otherwise deprives a defendant of meaningful representation, amounts to ineffective assistance of counsel. See People v. Turner, People v. Borrell. The appellate division held that appellate counsel was ineffective solely for failing to raise the removal issue on direct appeal, reasoning that the trial court's ejection of defendant without a warning immediately before his removal violated defendant's right to be present during a material stage of the trial, which would have required reversal of defendant's conviction. As we have explained, the trial court did not violate defendant's right because, at the time of trial, it was well established that warnings could be dispensed with when impracticable, like here. In other words, the appellate division erroneously concluded that the law was clear that the trial court committed reversible error and appellate counsel was not ineffective for failing to raise a meritless claim, Stultz. Moreover, and contrary to the dissent's interpretation, the affirmation from the supervising lawyer on defendant's direct appeal fails to establish that appellate counsel's advocacy in this case did not reflect a competent grasp of the facts, law, or appellate procedure regarding a defendant's right to be present in the courtroom. The affirmation declares that supervising counsel did not consider raising a challenge to defendant's removal from the courtroom, but critically fails to explain why. The absence of such reason is particularly curious given that counsel provides an explanation for his decision not to raise the youthful offender issue. He thought it unlikely the sentencing court would have granted defendant youthful offender status, and further admits that in making this decision he did not distinguish between general grounds and specific bases for such a request, citing People v. Middlebrooks. Counsel's silence as to the reasons for not considering the courtroom removal challenge cannot be determined from the record. Thus, defendant failed to meet his burden on a coram nobis petition of demonstrating that counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the removal issue. Alvarez. 4. The appellate division erroneously concluded that the trial court violated defendant's right to be present and therefore incorrectly granted defendant's writ of error coram nobis on the sole ground that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this meritless claim on direct appeal. Accordingly, the order should be reversed and the case remitted to the appellate division for consideration of issues raised but not determined by that court. Opinion by Judge Rivera. Chief Judge Wilson and Judges Singas, Cannataro, Troutman and Bannister concur. Judge Aaron's dissents in an opinion. Judges Garcia and Halligan took no part.
Decision podcasts are brought to you by the New York Prosecutors Training Institute. Find this and other decisions at NIPT Law, www.nipt.org/law.